This morning in our study of Luke chapter 8, we come to verse 51 and some of the other material too. But it says there that when Jesus had come to the house, he's talking about there the house of the ruler of the synagogue, he did not allow anyone to enter with him except Peter and John and James and the girl's father and mother. Now they were all weeping and lamenting for her, but he said, "Stop weeping, for she has not died, but is asleep." And they began laughing at him, knowing that she had died. He, however, took her by the hand and called, saying, "Child, arise." And her spirit returned, and she rose immediately, and he gave orders for something to be given to her to eat, and her parents were amazed, but he instructed them to tell no one what had happened. The record here in Luke doesn't read as smoothly as some of the other records do in Matthew and Mark, because it's pretty clear that we're supposed to understand in verse 51 that there were only five witnesses to this event, but the material in verse 52 and 53 is followed hard on the heels by verse 54 and almost gives you the impression that they were laughing while he was doing this, and that's not the case. Verses 52 and 53 actually fit right into verse 51 at the end of the word house in terms of the actual way it worked. He came to Jairus' house. Everybody was weeping and lamenting, and he told them to quit because she was just asleep, and they laughed at him because they knew she had died. And then he wouldn't allow anyone to enter into the room where the girl was, except Peter, John, and James, and the father of the girl and her mother. And he took her by the hand and said, "Child, arise." So that's the order of the event. Now, in our study last time, we were looking into Luke's revelation of a pretty major area in verse 50, where Jesus heard the report from the synagogue ruler's house, and they told him that his daughter had died, verse 49, and that he didn't need to be troubling Jesus anymore. And when Jesus heard that report, he said to Jairus, "Don't be afraid any longer, or stop being afraid. Only believe, and she shall be saved or made well." The issue there in that study was the issue of why faith is often not the response that people give to the words of God, because it's clear from verse 56 that Jairus let his statement, "Stop being afraid, believe." He let it go in one ear and right out the other, because he would not have been, in verse 56, amazed if he had believed. This is the weight of the impact of faith. When you believe something, it affects the way you look at stuff. And if he had believed Jesus, he wouldn't have been surprised at all, because Jesus had told him, "If you stop being afraid, just believe, and she shall be made whole." But the fact that he didn't does raise the question of why didn't he? Why is faith often not the response that people give when God's Word says something? And we saw in our study last time that when people are settled into an attitude of entitlement like Jairus was, faith is pretty much impossible. It's impossible to trust when you have the attitude that you deserve better than what you're getting. And the reason for that's not really hard to find in the Scriptures. Faith is supposed to be in the God of all grace. And most people just reject grace out of hand. Oh, they say they believe it, but the fact is, most people just do not buy into grace. Therefore, they do not believe in the God of all grace. And when they don't believe in the God of all grace, that's the unbelief that we're seeing. And the reason for their rejection isn't really hard either. Faith is supposed to be in the God of all grace. But if you don't really commit to the God of all grace as a grace issue, then you're not going to believe. And why wouldn't anybody believe in the grace of God? Well, the only realm in which grace functions is the realm of the lack of merit. And most folks deal with that by either contradicting it. They say things like, well, I didn't do anything to deserve this. Or, why is this happening to me? Or something along that line. And all of that is just contradicting grace. Grace says, you do deserve far more than what you're experiencing. And it is by the grace of God that you don't experience the far worse. In fact, you experience much more in terms of goodness. So that's one reason people reject it, because they will not accept the lack of merit concept that grace assumes. It's always, well, but I did, and all of that is all meritorious. You know, God owes me better than what I've got. That's one side of the coin. The other side is those people who have finally been beaten down by all the stuff that's happening to them, and they can see the connection between what they did and why this is like it is, and they just wallow in it. I'm getting just what I deserve. You know, what goes around comes around. This is all happening to me because of what I've done. But that's just as much a rejection of grace as the other one is. Because that says, in effect, there's no grace for those that don't deserve it. I thought that's what the other side was. You see how grace is one of those areas that people just shy away from big time. And that rejection blocks faith in the God of grace. Because that's how He's revealed to us, as a God of all grace. And this is no small thing. There's too much at stake in the issue of faith in the grace of God to be ignored. You just ignore it at your own risk, because all of our experience of the life that God has available for us to experience is tied to the issue of whether we believe Him or not. And where there is no faith, there is no life. Even if God's done everything except the believing. If you don't believe Him, there's no life. So Luke deliberately spent a good portion of his effort in this last part of chapter 8 trying to sharpen our focus on the issues of the outcome of faith and the hindrances to it. Now this morning, as we work our way into verse 51 and following, our study is going to be on a portion of Jesus' actions in the face of the unbelief, so that we can consider whether we need to enter more fully into our understanding of the God of all grace. I really believe that verse 51, in the light of verses 52 and following, is an attempt on Luke's part to push us in the direction of believing what we're seeing here, rather than just blowing it off. It says in verse 51 that when Jesus had come to the house where Jairus and his family lived, all of the people were weeping and lamenting because the girl had died, and he said, stop all this emotional stuff, because she's not dead, she's asleep. And they began laughing at him, knowing that she had died. And he did not allow anyone to enter with him except Peter and John and James and the girl's father and the mother. What's going on here? Well, I believe that what's going on here is that Luke is presenting us with the face of unbelief. And I want us to consider that. He told that woman who had sneaked up behind him and surreptitiously reached out and touched the fringe of his garment, that her faith, verse 48, was what God responded to in healing her 12-year-long problem with the issue of blood. She believed, and God responded. That's the issue of how faith works. When you have a legitimate concept of faith, and you exercise it, God acts, even if your concept is very, very tenuous, so that it's like a grain of mustard seed. But what about Jairus and his wife and that whole household when Jesus said, stop being afraid, just believe, and it's all going to be okay. And they just let that go. What is this face of unbelief? Well, I believe that the first thing Luke wants us to come away from this paragraph understanding is that the face of unbelief is contorted by emotional upheaval. All of us have seen demonstrations either in person or television or movie productions of somebody who has just been scared witless, and they're just out of it, screaming and carrying on, and somebody's trying to get their attention to tell them that everything's okay, and they won't listen because they're screaming and carrying on, so the person just slaps them across the face hard enough to hurt, and it shuts off that emotional reaction and stuns them enough to where they can hear. Now, I don't recommend you go around slapping people, but sometimes you got to get somebody's attention, and that's the face of the upheaval of emotion that's out of control. And I believe that part of Luke's point here in Luke 8, in dealing with Jairus and his wife, is that he's showing us the contorted face of unbelief caused by the emotional upheaval. There is a reason in verse 50 that Jesus said, "Stop being afraid." There's a reason for that. He didn't just say that so he'd have something to say. And quite frankly, he didn't say it just because Jairus needed to be encouraged. He told him to stop being afraid because there was something going on here that was going to just eliminate Jairus' ability to respond to things properly. The reason Jesus said stop being afraid is because fear is not only an expression of unbelief, it's an effective opponent of it. When you're emotionally wrought out, you do not think straight. And when your mind is in neutral and all the gears are spinning like crazy, you're not going to be believing. Believing is something that you do as a rational response to revelation given. And that means your mind's got to be in gear. And that means the emotions have to be in their place. So when Jesus said, "Stop being afraid," he meant it. Did Jairus do it? No. In verse 52, he gets to the house and everybody's weeping, and the word translated lamenting means they were striking themselves. You've all seen the pictures of people in the Middle East who have suffered some great tragedy, and they beat themselves, they slap their heads, they all kinds of violence to their own bodies as an expression of their grief. Well, that's the same kind of thing that's going on here in verse 52. These people are in deep mourning. They're weeping and they're slapping themselves, striking themselves. The mourning is very profound, and these are expressions of emotional upheaval that are the expression of the contradiction that loss has created between what I wanted to happen and what happened, and the hopelessness of what I believed would be okay and what actually transpired to show me that my faith was worthless. People go into this lamenting and smiting themselves emotional stuff when something terrible has happened that they didn't want to happen. That's the contradiction of love. And they do it in a sense of hopelessness because that's the character of having your love denied you in such a profoundly open way. Jairus and his wife had one child, and they did not want to lose her. And they hoped that she would grow up and marry and give them grandchildren to bounce on their knee. They had all kinds of aspirations for this girl. And those loves that they had were completely contradicted the day she died. And their confidence that things were going to work fine for their daughter was smashed. And that's what the weeping and the wailing was all about. That's the normal reaction. Everybody does it when their loves are demolished and their faith is shot. So that's the picture
A lot of emotion. Verse 50, stop being afraid. Verse 52, everybody's in this emotional condition. And Jesus says, stop. Stop weeping. She's not dead. She's asleep. There's a reason that Jesus said that. And there's a reason why they laughed at him when he said it. It's a little bit embarrassing to misinterpret certain events and get all emotionally wrought up by them, to have somebody come along and say, that isn't the way it is. And then they straighten you out in terms of the way it is. And then you're embarrassed by the fact that you went to this, you know, you just fell apart emotionally over this thing and you didn't even understand it. It's just, so it's embarrassing. Well, what do you do when you're embarrassed? Well, you don't like it. But these people, when he said, stop this, they just laughed at him because they were just as sure as they could be that their understanding of what was going on was right. So here we have the face of unbelief contorted by emotional upheaval. Now I want to warn you something about emotional upheaval, because emotion is a very potent seductress. Everybody knows that emotion is the essence of life and death. I've said this a gazillion times. If you died and went to hell and you were just filled with joy, you wouldn't even know you were in hell. And if you died and went to heaven and you were just filled with grief and turmoil and all, you wouldn't know you were in heaven. And the reason? Because of your emotions. Everybody knows this. Emotions are what makes life good or terrible. The rest of the stuff is kind of on the side. You can look at a very bad scenario, understand it with your head, and as long as your emotions are detached from it, it doesn't faze you. You don't care. But you can look at something and without any understanding, recognize how horrible it is and go into this emotional, and you're not thinking anymore. But you're experiencing the essence of life and death. That's what emotion is. Take that away and you don't have life or death anymore. And that's the reason it's so potent. Because it is the essence of life and death, but it's not the root of either. People don't get into emotional stuff just to do it. There's a root that drives that. And as we've already seen, the roots have to do with what you consider to be important and what your expectation was, love and faith. Now, when you take this emotion that is rooted in what you believe is valuable and what you consider to be true, and your reaction to the things that happen based on those two realities either give you joy or grief, when you look at that way, and then you couple that to man's fallen state, emotion turns out to be a replacement for God. And it gives place to reason with great reluctance. I just want to feel happy, joyful. Well, how about experiencing the presence of God? If that'll bring me joy. Well, what if experiencing the presence of God doesn't bring you joy? Well, then I'd rather just be joyful. Well, it's a tremendous seductress. You have to ask yourself, what do you really want? So that's the face of unbelief contorted by emotional upheaval. There's a lot of junk going on here in verses 50 through 56. The people are just sure they understand what's going on, and Jesus just knows they don't. But who are they going to believe? Him or themselves? Well, we already know. So it's written there. Jesus says, stop this, and they don't stop. And he says, stop this, and they laugh at him. Stop it! I'd have to believe you to stop it. Oh. Now that's the face of unbelief. But there is another thing about this face, and that is that it has this enormous body beneath it. And this body that's beneath the face is submerged like an iceberg.
the reason that the vast majority of icebergs are beneath the surface is that they're made out of the water and oxygen combination that was there when it was frozen, and they can only lift a little bit, and so the tip of the berg is out of the water, and you can see that. But in order for you to see that, there's got to be this huge block underneath pushing up so that that part shows up. Well, what we've looked at so far is the part that shows up, the fear and the weeping and the wailing and all that. What's underneath it? Look over at Luke chapter 24. You all know the story that's recorded in Luke 24. Jesus had been crucified, and he had told them over and over that he was going to rise from the dead on the third day. He'd said that. But they paid about as much attention to him as Jairus did. So, after he was crucified, in verse 13 it says, two of them were going that very day to a village named Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. And they were talking about what all was going on. So Jesus, after he was raised, approached them and hid their eyes from recognition of him, verse 16. And he said, what are you guys talking about? And they stopped, and they looked very sad. So let me ask you this. This looking sad, were they just putting on a front, or did they not believe that Jesus was raised from the dead? Well, you already know the answer. They didn't believe it. And one of them, named Cleopas, answered and said to him, are you the only one visiting Jerusalem and unaware of the things that have happened there? Now, this is, you know, sarcastic. And he said, oh, what things? And they said, things about Jesus, the Nazarene, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word in the sight of God and all the people, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him up to the sentence of death and crucified him. And we were hoping that it was he who was going to redeem Israel. And indeed, besides all this, it's the third day since these things happened. And some of the women among us amazed us. They went to the tomb early, and they didn't find his body, and they came saying they'd seen in the vision of angels and said he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just like they said, but they didn't see him. So we took off to go to Emmaus, because we don't believe the women, we don't believe who went to the tomb, we don't believe what Jesus said before he was crucified about being raised on the third day. We don't believe any of that stuff. And he said in verse 25, oh, mindless men. That word translated foolish means you're not using your brain. And that's not the biggest problem. The next phrase, slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken. You see, underneath the face of unbelief, there's this submerged enormity that says, I can hear this and hear it 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 and still not believe it. That's what that submerged thing means. I have this capacity in myself to be exposed to this truth over and over and over and over and over and over until I'm sick of being exposed to it because I don't believe that. You see, there's a reason that the disciples were mindless. Oh, mindless guys, slow of heart to believe. What he's talking about is that submerged reality. Do you think it's a tragedy or a travesty or any of those kind of words like I do that after Jesus had fed, oh, I don't know, 10, 15,000 people in one sitting, 5,000 of them were military-age men, that he had cleansed I don't know how many lepers and raised who knows all from beds of illness and disease and all that for approximately 7 years of doing this. Do you think it's kind of sad that in the upper room there were 120 people? Jesus asked a Samaritan leper that he cleansed. When he cleansed 10, 9 of them were Jews. The Samaritan turned back to give thanks, and Jesus said,
Where are the nine?
Well, my question is, where are the 9,000 who ate the free bread and fish? Watched him do all these miracles, participated in them. How come there are only 120? How is it that at the cross there was only one disciple? How is it that the Apostle Paul, at the end of his life of ministry and care for others, said, nobody stood with me? See, there's this huge thing floating beneath the face of unbelief. And that huge thing is a heart that's slow to believe. So that's the issue. I believe that's part of what's going on here in Luke chapter 8. Luke chapter 8 is not the first time that Jesus dealt with a dead person. You remember the story of the widow of Nain? So we see the face and we understand the body of unbelief. Verse 51 of Luke 8 says, and when he came to the house, he did not allow anyone to enter with him except Peter and John and James and the girl's father and mother. And he told the people to stop their crying because she wasn't dead, she was asleep. What is going on here? Well, I believe that what we are reading in verse 51 is a certain kind of exclusiveness that Jesus exercised. Peter, John, and James were often selected by Jesus for special privilege. And Luke is recording here in verse 51 that Jesus deliberately refused to permit the majority of those that were involved to enter with him into the place where the child lay. Now, Jesus never did anything mindlessly, so he had to have a reason for this. And Luke, under the inspiration of the Spirit of God, did not record anything mindlessly, so he had to have a reason for telling us that Jesus did this. What would those reasons be? Well, Luke told us who was permitted to accompany Jesus into the room, Peter, John, and James, out of the 12. That leaves 9 men, you guys out here. Jairus and his wife, but everybody else, you guys going out. Now that means that Luke leaves us with his record to wonder and to look in his record to see if there are any reasons why Jesus would do this. I think it's easier to understand why Jesus let the father of the child and the mother go in with him, because after all, it was their house and it was their daughter. So, you know, I don't have a problem with that. But how do you deal with the fact that Peter, John, and James get this favored treatment and the other 9 are left outside? I want to prejudice your thinking before you answer that question by looking over at Luke chapter 22. In Luke 22, Jesus was actually observing the Lord's table. And in the process, it says in verse 23, they began to discuss among themselves which of them it might be who was going to do this thing called betraying the Son of Man, verse 22. And immediately on saying that, Luke says this, and there arose also a dispute among them as to which of them was regarded to be the greatest. Now, picture this in your mind. This is the night before Jesus is to be crucified. Jesus has just got through telling them that one of them in that room is going to betray him. And they want to argue about who's the greatest in the kingdom. Now, what does that tell you about them? Well, it tells me that they had been asleep during his entire teaching ministry about the nature of the kingdom being a kingdom of servants. They didn't hear a word he said. And it also tells me that there's this huge submerged thing beneath the face of unbelief that says, there are some things that I will not give up on. There are some things that I will have regardless. And one of those things is, I will have my reputation to be established above all of the rest of you guys. I will have this. And given that's a large part of the disciples' submerged reality. They wanted to be greater than everybody else. That was a huge part of that submerged thing. So, what was Jesus doing feeding into that? By selecting three and subjecting the other nine to exclusion. There is another record, but Luke doesn't record it. It's found in Mark chapter 10, where James and John came to Jesus one day and they said, and their mother, by the way, was with them, and they said, Master, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. And he said, well, what is it that you want to know? Or you want to ask? They said, well, we'll leave this part up to you. You can choose however you want to do this, but what we want is, one of us wants the right-hand place in the kingdom, and the other one wants the left. Now, you can decide who gets the right and the left, but we want those two spots. And the text in Mark 10:41 says that when the other 10 heard about it, they were very upset. Now, I've told you this to get your mind thinking about what happens in Luke 8 when Jesus says, Peter, John, James, you guys come with me. You other guys, stay out here. Now, if you're Peter, John, or James, you feel pretty good. But if you're Matthew or Thomas, or you feel, oh, what's going on? How come they get a go in? I don't. I'm not creating anything here except what I believe is right in this reality. And also, when Jesus told those who were doing all the weeping and the wailing, stop weeping. She has not died. She is asleep. And they laughed at him because they were sure she had died. Now, Jesus didn't let any of those people who were doing the weeping and the wailing in that room to watch what he was going to do. I really believe that what's going on here is that Jesus is leaving the door open for people's attitudes to either reinforce their unbelief or to come to faith, one or the other. Because, see, in order to come to faith, they have got to get rid of this problem that being excluded creates for them. What is that problem? Well, why are you excluding me? How come I don't get to be in there? Why is it? What is it about me that you don't like? What is that? That sense of entitlement. I told you earlier. You see, when Jesus told the emotional crowd that their emotion was being wasted, and they laughed at him, and he didn't let them see him raise her from the dead, you know the next thing they saw? They saw this 12-year-old girl come out of the room munching on something to eat because he commanded them to give her something to eat. And they looked at her and said, well, I guess he was right. She was just asleep. See, that allows them to continue in their disbelief. They don't have to acknowledge that he raised her from the dead. All they have to acknowledge is, well, I thought she was dead, but I guess she really wasn't. Now, they thought she was dead strong enough to laugh at him when he said she wasn't. But after the fact, and they see her walking around, but they didn't get to see him raise her, they say, maybe I was wrong. Now, why would you be willing to admit you were wrong when you knew you were right? Only if you want to keep on being unbelieving. Well, what about the nine? Jesus deliberately selects three and says, you guys come with me, you others stay out here. And they hear the people laugh. They heard the guy report to Jairus that his daughter died. There's no use in troubling Jesus anymore. They heard all that. In a little while, out comes this little girl, eating. And they look at her and say, Peter, John, James, what'd he do in there? How come I didn't get to see it? You see, if they wanted to be resentful, they could be, if they decided to go there. If they really wanted to compete with one another, here's a foundation for feeling slighted, because Jesus slighted them. Now, I believe that that is illustration of that huge submerged reality of the depravity of man. And when it's attached to a face of unbelief, there isn't any solution. The only solution is to start believing. Now, I believe that Jesus deliberately described Jairus and the woman with the issue of blood in the terms that he described them in so that faith could happen. You see, at the beginning I told you that faith has to be in the God of all grace or it's not going to be. You have to believe in grace or it's not going to be. Now, you can call anything faith that you want to call faith, but if it's not in the God of grace, then it's not faith anymore. It's some distortion. Well, I believe that Luke deliberately portrayed Jairus in verses 41 and 42, and he deliberately portrayed the woman with the hemorrhage in verse 43 and 44 in negative, derogatory, descriptive phrases. They both, Jairus and the woman, come out looking like they didn't deserve Jesus to treat them that way. And guess what? They didn't. That's Luke's whole point. Because what's on display here is the God of all grace. And if you stick deserve in there, you destroy grace, and so there can't be any faith. If you're angry and resentful because Jesus selected those three and left you out, side, you only get angry or resentful if one of two things is the case. You either think that you're better than they are and should have been given the opportunity they were given, or you think that they have disqualified themselves significantly in some way so that they shouldn't have been given the same privilege, or they should have been excluded like you. One or the other. You're either going to feel superior to them, or you're going to feel like, well, they certainly didn't deserve that. And in both cases, what has been flushed down the toilet? Grace. Grace is God doing for people what He requires of them with no regard for whether they're qualified to get it or not. If you'll allow me to say it this way, when Jesus died on Calvary, He made it possible for God to just ignore whether they deserved it or not. Makes no difference to Him. He's gracious. And this is where the issue of faith finally finds its foundation. In this submerged reality of depravity, we have these commitments. Deep-seated, mind-confusing, faith-denying commitments. I will be, I will have, I am going to. And all the time, everything Jesus is saying is going right through. In one ear, out the other. Makes no difference what He said. I've already got my agenda and I'm going to pursue it regardless. That's that depravity thing. Well, how in the world do you ever get over it? Only by grace. If a person is open to the idea of grace, then the submerged reality can begin to be affected, and a couple of things will start happening. If I'm committed to grace, I will find my desire to be greater than others diminishing, because grace doesn't allow for greatness on the basis of merit. Impossible. So if I really buy into it, I don't care anymore whether I'm greater than somebody else or not, because the foundations for that are carnal. And that will enable me to do a couple of things really quickly. I can stop posturing and being a hypocrite. I don't have to impress anybody anymore because it isn't about what I have accomplished or done. It's about the God of all grace. And then, if I'm not posturing and being hypocritical, then other people won't be put off by my posturing and hypocrisy, and then there'll be more harmony and less conflict. That's the way it works. So that's one of the things that'll happen if I really buy into grace.
And then, secondly, if I really buy into grace, there will be in me, in this submerged reality, a growing comfort with whatever Jesus decides to do, because He's the God of all grace. So, whatever He does will be gracious souled. What have I got to complain about? And that, being more and more comfortable with what Jesus does or doesn't do, allows my emotions to be tempered and kept in their place. And I will have a greater faith in the outcomes because they're guarded by grace. So, though I won't be emotionally dead, I will not be a slave to it anymore. I won't go into these tailspins where somebody has to slap me to get me to stop and think a minute, because I believe in grace. See, this is the issue. This is Luke's point. That woman that had the issue of blood was healed because she trusted, not because she qualified. She was making everybody unclean that she touched, and she knew it. And she was afraid because she knew it. Jairus was the head of a synagogue that taught all kinds of heretical stuff in terms of whether the Bible would support it or not, though he claimed the Bible did. He was responsible for the attitude of so many of the unbelievers that heard what Jesus said and paid no attention because he didn't pay any attention. And Jesus came along, and when he said, "My daughter's dying, come help," he just did it. He didn't say, "I know you don't deserve it." He didn't. But if he'd have said that, what would we have concluded? You got to deserve it. And what would that do to grace? And if it destroys grace, you know where you're going to be caught? In trying to come up with some reason so that you can be healthy and secure and prosperous and wise and all that without any grace involved, because you don't believe in that. You believe you've got to be qualified. And that's where the fears all are, folks. The reason Jesus said stop being afraid is because, boy, if you're operating by fear, you're not operating by grace. If you're weeping and wailing over things, and when Jesus says stop that, that's not the way it is. And you ignore Him, it's because you've dismissed grace. The real grace is in verse 54. He takes the little girl by the hand and says, "Child, arise." Now, I realize that some things have changed in the last couple thousand years, and there aren't any records that I know of anybody who's able to raise people back from the dead and all. I mean, I've heard of claims being made and all that, but I know this has not changed grace. God is still not in the business of saying, "Well, he deserves it, so I'll give it to him. She doesn't deserve it, so forget her." Yeah, they deserve it, so they'll get it. But they don't, so they won't. That kind of terminology is not in God's vocabulary. He's God of all grace. And the only thing that keeps us from being able to participate in His life is whether we believe it or not. Let's pray. Father, we all know about that submerged iceberg where Your Word says things and we just blow it off because we don't want to hear that. Doesn't fit. We all feel the guilt of having responded to You that way, and we ask that You would forgive us. And we ask that You would give us an understanding of Your grace that gives us confidence in the face of our own demerit, that we are a people who can depend on the gracious God for life. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.